water heaters. Scriffield Solar and Heating can be reached at 825-0759 or at scriffieldsolarandheating.com. Coming up next is Thursday Night Talk. Lorna Bryan is our host. It is 7 p.m. here on KHSU.
Good evening and welcome to a special Town Hall Thursday Night Talk. I'm your host, Lorna Bryant. We're going to begin with a clip. Let's listen to that clip now.
In a time of sorrow, it is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why? What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Whenever any American's life is taken by another American unnecessarily, whether it is done in the name of the law or in defiance of the law, by one man or by a gang, in cold blood or in passion, in an attack of violence or in response to violence, whenever we tear at the fabric of our lives, which another man has painfully and clumsily woven for himself and his children, whenever we do this, then the whole nation is degraded. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet we seemingly tolerate a rising level of violence that ignores our common humanity and our claims to civilization alike. We calmly accept newspaper reports of civilian slaughter in far-off lands. We glorify killing on movie and television screens, and we call it entertainment. We'd make it easier for men of all shades of sanity to acquire weapons and ammunition that they desire. Too often we honor swagger and bluster and the wielders of force. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. Some Americans who preach nonviolence abroad fail to practice it here at home. Some accuse others of rioting and inciting riots, have by their own conduct invited them. Some look for scapegoats Others look for conspiracies. But this much is clear. Violence breeds violence. Repression breeds retaliation. And only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls.
That was Robert F. Kennedy, and it was a clip of a speech delivered on April 5th, 1968, in the City Club in Cleveland, Ohio, the day after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Kennedy would be gunned down just 2 months later on June 6, 1968. Those words, although spoken 47 years ago, are relevant to what's going on in this world today. I'm sure you're aware of the news of the gruesome, tragic terrorist attack that occurred in Nice, France this afternoon. And there will be more information about that later. But tonight, as you are aware, sometimes it takes a tragedy to begin a dialogue. Although there have been several tragedies to rock our nation over the past few years, last week left our country reeling. In the early morning hours of Tuesday, July 5th, Alton Sterling was fatally shot in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, while selling bootleg CDs outside of a convenience store. The following day, Philando Castile was fatally shot in Falcon Heights, a suburb of St. Paul, Minnesota. Both men died at the hands of police officers. A day after the Minnesota incident, 11 police officers were, five of them fatally, were gunned down by a lone shooter. One civilian in that attack was wounded and survived. These back-to-back-to-back events left our country on edge and looking for answers. Finally, everyone acknowledges this elephant we have in the room. It's time to begin a discussion. Of course, the discussion that we will have tonight, we won't find the answer, but perhaps collectively, we can help each other effect change in our own backyard. I'm going to offer the floor to my guest tonight, but I just want to share with you to begin. This is a special show. It's normally an hour. Tonight it will be 2 hours. It will be broken up into four sections. In the first half hour, we'll have a general discussion. We won't take phone calls during that time just to get the discussion rolling. In the second half hour, we will discuss Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. We'll open up the phone calls at that time. We'll talk about what that means. In the second hour at from 8 to 8:30, we will discuss police brutality against people of color, and we'll discuss racial profiling. In the final half hour, we will discuss where we go from here. So I'm going to open up the floor and start at my left and ask each of my guests to introduce themselves and give a bit of background about who they are, who they represent, and what they intend to walk away from this discussion this evening.
Hello. Hello, everyone. My name is Tay Triggs, and I am Associate Dean for Student Engagement and Leadership at Humboldt State University. I've been living here in Arcata for the last 4 years. And I am raising a 9-year-old daughter here. And what I hope to gain from this discussion is, number one, different perspectives, and also just to hear other people's experiences in regards to violence in our country.
Paula?
Hi, I'm Paula Nettelkoff. I'm a licensed marriage family therapist and mother of an African-American son. One of my areas, I've been up here since 72, and one of the areas of experience, I would say, is starting one of the first domestic violence batterers program and working with people and making changes in their behaviors, violence within their homes, and working with people throughout the state and throughout the country, and at times with people in Israel working together, trying to look at why and how we tolerate violence. What I hope to get out of tonight is the safety of having difficult dialogue and being able to listen and hear each other without maybe so much defensiveness.
Mikey?
Hi. my name is Michael Matthews, the second. Definitely welcome to call me Mikey. I am a citizen, just a really concerned citizen, person of color, African American. That's definitely looking for some answers, some solutions to bring about some sort of change to, you know, to everything that's been going on. Not just now, but that's been going on for years. And hopefully I walk away today with more understanding of different perspectives, and become more active, a little bit more vocal in my spaces, and hopefully take some tools, take away some wisdoms from everyone, and use it for myself, and hopefully create something that can provide some sort of changes for my people.
Jeff?
I'm Jeff Blank. I'm here in my capacity as the member of the Eureka NAACP. I've been an attorney for over 30 years. I'm the former president of the Reno Sparks NAACP, and I'm a life member. I was the first white president of the Reno Sparks branch in 70 years, and that was got some attention because it works both ways. And I've also presented at the NAACP National Convention legal seminars on the school-to-prison pipeline. And my interest in the NAACP arose when, get my anniversary right here, 19 years ago I married my black wife. We now have two black sons who are 16 and 18 years old. And as a white male, I'm at a loss as to tell them how they can be safe. So hopefully tonight, you know, we can hear from people, the others here in the room. And I think coming from a white parent of black children is to help educate the white population on, number one, the perspective of the black population and what we as the white population need to do.
Don?
Good evening. Thank you for having me. My name is Don Peterson. I'm the chief of police at Humboldt State University. And prior to my service at Humboldt State, I was a member of the Broward Sheriff's Office, and that's in South Florida. The time that I spent with the Broward Sheriff's Office was 30 years, and that's an area in South Florida that's a very diverse environment, and I spent my entire career working in a very diverse environment. I'm very proud of that. And I came here. I grew up a little south of here in Sonoma County, and I got to come home to California, and I feel like I'm home now, and I've been embraced by the Humboldt State University community. And one of the things I'm excited about is that I am not responding to crises as I was for so many years. I'm now able to actually practice, not talk about, but practice community policing and listen to students and listen to people and listen to people to share their experiences. And I would just, I guess, conclude my introduction by saying that my wife and I recently experienced my son departing home and heading to Colorado. And as a privileged white man, I said, let him drive. It'll be good for him to get that experience. And my wife and I talked, and I really came around very, very quickly to the realization that no, I'm not sure I want my son driving across the country from Florida to Colorado in a car with Florida plates, because I might be able to do that and I might not get stopped, but I'm not so sure about my son. And my son as a police officer, and some of my counterparts might cringe to hear me say that, but I think there are plenty of police people out there who have some of the same concerns that are being expressed across the nation. We're not immune, and I certainly had those concerns. And we chose to incur the cost of shipping his car and putting him on a plane and making sure that he got there safe. So I'm really happy to be here, and I'm really interested in participating and hearing the dialogue.
This most definitely will be an interesting dialogue, like you said, coming from the perspective of three white members in the community. Actually, the three white guests all have black sons. I myself, as an African-American woman, have an adult black son. And I remember when he was young, hearing in rap songs and in the news that black males are not expected to exceed 25 years of age in the inner city. That really struck a chord coming from Los Angeles. And thankfully, we moved here to Humboldt County, no longer in the inner city, but I still had worries for my son. I'm going to start with you, Mikey. Yeah. You're from the same community as I am in Los Angeles. Do you remember what that was like growing up hearing that before you moved here?
Oh, totally. As you were saying, just through the different types of media, I mean, through music, through news, through, I mean, whatever way of media, there is always this expectation for black males not exceeding past a certain age because of the increasing crime rates and just all the everything that was going on in that space. I mean, coming from South Central LA, being a black male, you are definitely at a high risk just from all different types of issues. And so, yeah, growing up there, I definitely felt pretty tense. It's definitely tense a lot of the times. It's because have to watch out what you're doing, what you're wearing, what you're saying, how you act, basically. And it's just, and no offense to you, just around policemen. Don, sorry. Just even around policemen, it's just like, you know, just kind of have to have this sort of put on this mask or put it on a certain front to kind of like, you know, not express any sort of fright or like, you know, because it's like if I do anything wrong, then they'll attack me or they'll find any sort of reason to put me in jail, you know. So it was really hard to kind of move around. Just, you know, I'm not involved in any kind of gangs or haven't done anything wrong. But for the most part, you know, it's just had to be very cautious of how I, you know, displayed myself, you know.
How old were you when you moved here to Humboldt County?
I was 17, yeah.
And since moving here, have you gotten that phone call from someone in your old neighborhood saying that someone that you knew died as a result of gun violence?
Oh, totally, without a doubt, yeah. It affects everybody.
So also since you've been here, do you have an ease sense of comfort with any interaction with police officers here versus Los Angeles?
There's not so much. Mm. Not so much. I mean, there's a slight change, you know, to being in a different space, you know, because this place is completely on the other side of the spectrum compared to LA. There is a little bit of ease, but for the most part, there's still that, you know, that little feeling just like I gotta kind of keep my head on a swivel, you know, because I don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, get me caught. You know, just, and this is just me being a person, just being human, you know, just being me. Yeah.
Don, how does that make you feel to hear this young black man say, you know, things don't feel different in this rural community?
I guess the thing that I would say first is, Mikey, you don't owe me an apology. And I think the way we're going to heal. I listened to Robert Kennedy speak, and you hit the nail on the head. His words were so relevant now. And I think that if I were to, or my counterparts, the folks that are in uniform, to get defensive and to not be open to hearing words, words will not hurt me. And Mikey does not owe me an apology. Mikey's experiences are incredibly valid, and there's an awful lot I can learn from listening to what Mikey's experiences were in L.A., and then what Mikey's experiences have been here in Humboldt County. And as I go about leading my agency, I need to hear Mikey and not hear him in a subordinate way and not hear him in a way where he feels that he needs to apologize, but hear him as a human being of equal stature to me and to anybody else at this table, independent of his skin color or his gender. And I think that if we can get dialogue going in that direction, we'll be a lot better off. And I think right now that's sadly lacking. And I think that when I hear Mikey talk about having to keep his head on a swivel, and when I hear Mikey talk about the experiences of getting phone calls from LA and having experiences right here in Humboldt County, a place that I love, it's very, very disturbing. It's heartbreaking. I don't want it for my community.
Jeff, I'm going to turn to you now. You moved from Reno, Nevada. I don't know what the demographics are, but it is a smaller town than, say, Las Vegas or Los Angeles.
400,000.
And what's the African-American population like there?
Percentage-wise, it's like 6%, which is similar to what it is here. The numbers are obviously more just because it's a larger community. But the demographics were 6% is black, 27 to 30% Hispanic, and that was the growing population. And there was a percentage of Native American population as well because of the Paiutes and the Washoes that were there. So compared to Humboldt County, it's similar.
Did you have any concerns moving here to this community with African American or, in this case, biracial children?
Well, first, it was when we had our children, my wife looked at me and she says, "We're going to raise our children and call them black, aren't we?" And I go, "Yeah." I don't know what else to call them, but yeah, I agree. And the concerns, I mean, there was concerns in Reno.
Uh-huh.
There would have been just a shooting of a black man that was pulled over and tried to leave and disputes as to did he hit the police officer with his mirror or not, and he's dead. There's also concerns in Reno that not only are we black, but we're Jewish. And twice the synagogue we belonged to was firebombed by white supremacists in Reno. So it was not paradise. but, you know, you manage and you do things and we got involved. And when we looked at Eureka, you know, we looked at the demographics and said, okay, how will our sons fit in? And we contacted, you know, counselors at Eureka High School and Arcata High School. And actually the demographics at Eureka High School, we thought were pretty good. It was 1,200 students, and the percentages were similar to everything at Reno. And we went on campus at lunchtime, and it wasn't real all white, you know, and that, because for our sons, it's like that would be difficult. Yeah, we did background on, you know, what were the incidents here. I guess the most prominent thing I found was the ACLU had just settled in January of 15, I think, its lawsuit with the, I don't know if it was the high school district or the Office of Education regarding discrimination that had occurred over the past 3 or 4 years before that. And that was comforting, saying, great, it's been just talked about, it's been dealt with, and things are in place now to help make it better. And I didn't come in naive to think that there wouldn't be any problems anywhere. People are people. But we've only been here a year, and I was talking with my wife, and we've had, unlike maybe some others who've been here longer, no negative interactions based on race in Eureka with my wife or my sons. So I just say, so far, so good. I have to say, we just drove back from Reno last weekend, and we went through Susanville, and Lassen County, and I used to have cases there with some, very few black people that were there. It's a pretty racist area. And my wife was driving the car. She's black. I had my seat reclined, so you really couldn't see me. We get into town, and there was a highway patrol officer just sitting. As soon as we passed, he pulls in behind her. And no lights, no siren. We go for several blocks, and the lights and siren go off. So she goes, what's going on? So we pull over, and he gets out. And then I put my seat up, but he didn't see me at first. And he comes over, and he starts saying, he goes, what are you? You don't know how to drive? You didn't see those two people walking in the crosswalk, you know, stepping off the curb? And then he sees me, and he stops. And I'm like, uh-huh. And my wife just said, I didn't see anyone. So then he's very polite, very nice, and gave her a ticket for failure to yield. And we, and you know, I asked my wife, I said, well, you know, are you upset about this? And she goes, no, this just happens. I was upset. And, you know, yeah, you will pay the ticket. You're not going to go back to Susanville and, you know, it's not worth it. And he knew it because there's no blacks living there. So if I give a black person a ticket, they're not coming back. So it happens. So far here, things have been good, but there's a lot going on that we want to make sure it doesn't happen.
Absolutely. I'm going to turn to you now, Paula. How you've lived here for quite some time. Mm-hmm. You have, you said, your wife said, we're going to call them black, right? What do you, are your sons black?
Yes, he's black. Okay. He'll be 25 next month. I think that I probably was under a privileged illusion that things would be different here. And I remember the talk that we had in high school, the talk of Arcata's a little safer than Eureka, and the instructions that I had to give him when he was going to go, as teenagers do, party and go see their friends in Eureka. I worked on California and Wabash. I knew the neighborhoods because of the line of work. The fact that I had to give the instructions was so difficult, and very difficult as a white woman thinking that she had the ability to raise a black male. It's been very humbling. Being graceful in the parenting, but hearing some of the things that he's gone through. I can recall when he was in Santa Monica living, just to take it a little from Humboldt, walking home from the junior college and being stopped and being accused of being affiliated, and had to take everything out of the backpack, had to take his shirts off to show his lack of tattoos. And again, having to really check myself with, what? This doesn't happen. Again, because of my privilege, my just naivete. So I think it's probably been better raising him in Arcata as an African-American male, but it's certainly, he's had a struggle. And because, you know, you're a mom, you feel that struggle.
Absolutely. Now, Tay, I'm going to turn to you. Mm-hmm. You have a 9-year-old, energetic, with a great, huge personality daughter. You also have an African-American male partner. What has it been like navigating through this community for your partner and for your daughter?
Gosh, we only have till 9. And not to sound completely negative, because as I've said before, there's been plenty of days, months on end where we haven't had any incidents. But, you know, it only takes a couple to kind of mar your entire experience. And, you know, my 9-year-old is She's truly a gift, and I'm lucky in that I've been able to really have deep conversations with her about race, about gender equality, about lots of things, about body size acceptance and all those things. And so I'm really open with her, and I think part of the reason why is because, you know, she's been raised on college campuses. You know, I often kid that it's the truth, but the first person to hold my daughter was the president of our student government association. She rushed to the hospital and was right there, like, where's the Triggs baby? You know, and so when we moved here, she started here in kindergarten. And I remember the first day she came home, and I was all excited, and, you know, I fought myself not to pick her up early so that I could find out how the day went and whatnot. And she came in the house, and she was just very quiet and really kind of melancholy. She just wasn't happy and chipper and upbeat. I'm like, what is going on, you know? And we sat down at dinner, and I asked her how the day go, and she said, Mom, I'm the only brown person in my whole class. I'm like, there's like 30 kids in your class. How's that possible? And what was more was that it was the first time that I realized that she recognized race and the difference in skin color. And I asked her, you know, why? What made you think about that? You know, because she's really, you know, anyone meets her knows she's very extroverted. She befriends everyone. She has a tendency to go after the kids who don't have friends. So she's a very compassionate 9-year-old. And she said that other people pointed it out to her all day.
Wow.
You know, so it was a fact that she couldn't escape. So by the end of the day, she's like, you know, I am the only brown face in this class, and that means something.
Mm.
And what does that mean, you know? And as the, you know, years went by, we started getting reports, my daughter as well as a few of the other African-American kids in the school were being called racial slurs by their classmates.
Other children,
yeah. And not just, you know, words they may have heard in a song, like the N-word, you know, or on some television show. I mean, these kids were using words that I hadn't heard since the 40s.
Throwback
racial terms.
Wow.
And, you know, so I had to sit her down and teach her what the N-word was and what that meant, and, you know, help her to understand that it wasn't about her, it was about their ignorance, and even try to move her a step past that in terms of forgiveness, because these are kids. And I told her, you know, this is learned, Sadie. This is something that, you know, their parents might be teaching them, or older brother, sister, or a grandpa, for some of the words, like a great-grandpa. I mean, it was throwback words, you know. And I think she understands that, you know. But one of the things that I noticed now that she's 9 is that she is obsessed with race and skin color.
Mm.
She constantly wants to talk about it. She notices it no matter where we go. And it's, you know, it's kind of heartbreaking because I just want her to be a 9-year-old.
You know, listening to you describe your daughter and her experiences, it makes me reflect on what I heard during the clip, the video that Lavish Reynolds broadcast live to the world as her boyfriend, her fiance, Philando Castile, after he was shot 5 times by a police officer. After he was shot, she was placed in a police car. Her 4-year-old daughter was in the back seat during the time of that shooting. And sometimes we have to, in fact, look to children for our own comfort. And in the clip from Lavish Reynolds, you can hear the comfort of her daughter. Let's hear that clip.
I can't really do because they got me handcuffed.
That's okay, Mommy.
I can't believe they just did this.
It's okay, I'm right here with you.
Not only the fact that a four-year-old child is placed in the position to comfort her mother after they both witnessed the man who was shot and killed right in front of them. We're going to open up the phones in this next half hour. I think we need to just move on from that clip. But I just wanted you to listen to that as we move into the second section of this night. And it's Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. People have varying thoughts about that. That hashtag that was first created. Let me reintroduce myself. Let's reintroduce each other. I'm Lorna Bryan. I'm the host for this evening. Next to me is Tay Trigg. She's the Associate Dean of Engagement and Leadership at Humboldt State. Paula Nettelkoff. She's a marriage and family therapist. Michael Matthews, an HSU graduate and citizen of this community, also known as Mikey. Jeff Blank, he's an NAACP member in the Eureka branch, and Chief of Police for Humboldt State University, Don Peterson. I want to begin this clip of a police officer in Ohio. This is an African-American woman who went to Facebook just to voice her opinions after the death of Alton Sterling and before the death became known of Philando Castile. Let's hear that clip.
Because not only am I a mother of two African-American sons, and I have African-American nephews, and I have brothers, I'm also a person that wears the uniform. I wear blue. So in 96, I took an oath in East Cleveland, sitting in front of Chief Guidance, that I would serve and protect my community by all costs, even if it meant I wouldn't go home to my one-year-old daughter. And that's what I did, and I did it with integrity and respect. No. The thing that hurt me most of all was that a lot of people that I was arresting were the same color as me, that grew up in East Cleveland like me, so I couldn't understand that. Why would you want to destroy your community? I couldn't understand. I said, okay, but they're not sworn to serve and protect either. They didn't take that oath. We are running around killing each other left and right. But what hurts me the most is the people that stood in front of a judge and stood in front of a mayor and said, I swear my oath that I will serve and protect this community. If you are white and you working in a black community and you are racist, you need to be ashamed of yourself. You stood up there and took an oath. If this is not where you want to work at, then you need to take your behind somewhere else. I decided to work in an African-American community because I'm African-American and I wanted to make a difference. But how dare you stand next to me in the same uniform and murder somebody? How dare you? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. So why don't we just keep it real? If you're that officer, then know good and well you got a God complex. You're afraid of people that don't look like you. You have no business in that uniform. Take it off. Take the uniform off. You have no business being a police officer. Because there's many of us that would give our life for anybody. And we took this oath and we meant it. If you are that officer that's prejudiced, take the uniform off and put the KKK hoodie on.
Think she was displaying just a little bit of emotion? I understand where she's coming from. The telephone number, if you'd like to join in the conversation, is 826-4805. If you're outside of the area, 1-800-640-5911. In 2003, the movement began with the use of the hashtag Black Lives Matter on social media. After the acquittal of George Zimmerman and the shooting death of African-American teen Trayvon Martin, Black Lives Matter became nationally recognized for its street demonstrations following the 2014 deaths of two African-Americans, Michael Brown, resulting in protest and unrest in Ferguson, and Eric Garner in New York City. Incidentally, Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza will speak here at Humboldt State University February 9th, 2017, as a part of the AS Presents lineup. So I see phones are ringing off the hook, but let's start with the panel here. Does anyone want to offer? Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I read something that was, you know, the Black Lives Matter, and then it gets All Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter and so forth. I think Black Lives Matter, I saw something that I think sums it up that says, no, all lives do matter. However, the way things are being handled, no one is showing that Black Lives Matter too. So it's part of that whole sentence, but you can't make a bumper sticker out of that whole sentence. So you just put on mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter, and it doesn't mean nobody else matters.
You know, before this show this evening, President Barack Obama was on ABC television. Thanks, Don, for letting me know of the town hall discussion that he was a part of. And when the Black Lives Matter conversation came up, President Obama said this evening that blacks have a specific vulnerability as it relates to this movement. So it's not negating other lives, but there is a specific vulnerability of black lives. And I thought it was beautiful that he just said that. Does anyone else want to chime in on the Black Lives Matter, the White Lives Matter, or excuse me, All Lives Matter, or the Blue Lives Matter, how there is this sense of division, you know?
Well, I think it's a perfect conversation to have because, I mean, I think this organization has been going for a while, and I think a lot of people have been really, confused about it, and I guess left with the impression that, you know, okay, just Black Lives Matter, nobody else matters, and feeling really offended by it. And I'm glad Jeff definitely came in with this, you know, with this explanation and kind of cleared the air with it, because it needs to be known so everybody can actually understand what it means. And mm-hmm. just doesn't mean like I matter, nobody else matters. That's it, right. You know. So, but I'm glad it's coming up and people are getting their frustrations out and actually having a conversation about it. And actually, it's necessary, and hopefully it can lead its way into a productive. Arena.
Right. We have a caller on the line, Kim from Eureka.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
I have been listening to the show, and I decided to call in because I have some concerns, and this will be a comment. I moved here from the East Coast 2 years ago. I retired from the federal government and bought a home here. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran, and I thought of buying a home here. This would be a nice area, peace and serenity. I'm a single woman, 60 years old. And it's not only black men being targeted, but as an African-American female moving here, I was targeted in 2015 by a Caucasian neighbor that came down and told me straight to my face that he did not want black people living on the block. I'm using the nice word. He didn't say black people. And from that point on, it's been an ongoing struggle with me being a member of the local NAACP, and I'm also a civil rights advocate. I'm not going to stand for it. I had conversations with the chief of police. It seemed like it was a cover-up, and I went one step further and had to get a restraining order, and then I went another step further, and I went to the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, because there is racism here in Eureka. It's subtle, but they're tricky and sneaky, and it has been made very clear to me that they don't want African-Americans living on the block where I live at, And by the way, it's only one other African-American woman married to a Caucasian male. And I stand firm that I understand the struggle that we're going through in this country, but this has taken it over the top with these recent senseless killing that has occurred across this country. It saddened me to this day that at age 60, I thought I would be seeing peace and harmony in this country. Mm-hmm. It's nothing but racism, and this country seemed like it's going backwards instead of forward.
Absolutely.
Where are our leaders? Where are our leaders? Where are our community activist leaders? I have chosen myself as being a civil rights liaison. If people have any concerns, I'm open to hear. But it's sad to know that I personally, after the Dallas attack, after Baton Rouge killing, the Minnesota killing, I am very fearful. I go out now looking and watching my back because I don't know when they're going to target African-American women. I'm educated. I have degrees. And I feel that I don't belong in this community. And it has been made very clear to me because I'm articulate. They always ask me, so why did you move to this area? Well, are you law enforcement? I used to work for the law enforcement 15 years. And I moved here, like I said, for peace and serenity. And I try and go out and talk to individuals every day, regardless of their skin color.
Absolutely.
And our country is based on this black and white issue. And it needs to stop.
Yes. Kim, for the sake of time, I'd like to thank you for your time. And if you could, your comment, if you could call back and leave your information so someone from this panel can contact you and we can continue the discussion.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. We have another caller, Dan from Eureka.
Yes.
Go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'd like to comment. I appreciate the comment that the lady made before. I agree with her. There is a subtle racism here. I've experienced it many times by police officers and also by some of the citizens of Eureka, California. I appreciate the two men of European descent expressing their opinions, and I really appreciate the police officer and his comments. We need more of that. We need more of European Americans coming forward and expressing their opinions about, you know, what's happening here in this country and in Eureka. And, you know, I do have some stories to tell, but maybe I can put them on Twitter or Facebook or anything like that. But I have experienced lots of racism here, right here in Eureka. I've lived here for probably 25 years. And every now and then it rears its ugly head, and it's here. And I appreciate your forum and what you're doing right now. We need more and more of that. We need a dialogue on this issue so that people can get involved, can hear other people of other races talking about how negative this is, how destructive this is, and maybe we can find some type of remedy and move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for your call, and thank you for your comment, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
You're
welcome. Thank you, guys. Thank you for talking and being there for, you know, the human race. It's all about every life matters. All lives matter.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have another call, Sandy from Eureka. Sandy, are you there? So we'll try to get Sandy in a moment. Anyone else want to chime in on the Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter?
What I really, again, I have to check myself about how I view the world or how I operate in the world. I have been so appalled watching the defensiveness of Caucasian friends that there was an offense. I was blinded or blindsided, I suppose the word is, by the defensiveness. It never occurred to me that when I see Black Lives Matter or outrage about things that are just plain wrong and unjust, that someone would take such defensiveness. It has opened my eyes to, again, getting outside of what my own kind world is in my personal life. And it's been very uncomfortable. It looks like we have Sandy. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Paula. Yes, we have Sandy from Crescent City on the line. Sandy?
Yes, I've been listening to your show, and like the commentator earlier stated, I was pulled over by a highway patrolman for supposedly trying to run down a pedestrian in a crosswalk. The man had his knife stick out. He was pounding it on his hand. He was very aggressive, and I really thought he was going to hit me. Mm. I am a 65-year-old, 5 foot, 115-pound female. I don't believe police brutality is a black-white issue. I think it's a power issue and an issue of who's hired to be a patrolman or a police officer.
Thank you for your comment. And coming up in the next hour, we are going to talk more about police brutality and profiling. I won't apologize to you, Don, being in this circle. We have another caller, Jamie from Arcata.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
You know, people tend to be, try to be very fair-minded and kind of start from a basis of saying, well, you know, each side has its points and each side has its faults and we need to come together. But really, the police need to clean up their act. They're the ones walking around with the power and the guns. They're the ones with the governmental authority. And they need to be more transparent and not just talk about transparency. In this week's North Coast Journal, the APD chief, Andrew Mills, says there needs to be more transparency, including the release of video, but his department is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money fighting a court battle to keep an EPD video from being released. So I know that he's not on, and I appreciate the words of the Arcata chief. But really, we need to talk to the power. They need to change their ways. They cannot expect people to somehow make it okay for them. They need more training. They probably need to be better paid so that they can have more training. So that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. Don, I won't put you on the spot. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, I think that some of the points that have been made speak to any specific one would be an injustice to all. And I guess since we're talking about Black Lives Matter, it always pisses me off when I hear people say all lives matter, because I think they're invalidating the point being made when people say Black Lives Matter. The one is a given. The other is a point that's trying to be made mm-hmm. by people who do not have privilege, who are oftentimes oppressed, who do have experiences that are very much different than mine. And if I cannot just give a little bit of myself to try to understand and to walk in their shoes, I should not be wearing the uniform that I'm wearing. And representing the folks in my uniform, the folks that I know and that I hang out with and that I serve with, they believe likewise. And yet we do see these examples. And I would say to, I think it was Sandy, she was able to call in. Some of the folks we're here talking about, they can't call in.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. What do you feel when you hear others in support of you say, Blue Lives Matter?
I don't like when it's talked about in the context of Black Lives Matter. I think it's a given. I think blue lives have always mattered. I've been in this profession for over 30 years, and I've never felt undervalued. When I've been spit at or attacked, there's been an outpouring of support. And I watched my colleague in Dallas, the leader that he is, and I watched what he's been going through, and I watched people from the community embracing that department. And I've just not known a time when blue lives didn't matter, and I don't think it maybe deserves to be in the same conversation. I think they're different conversations. And, you know, I guess I just leave it at that.
I recently saw an image that said, if this symbol, Black Lives Matter, bothers you, but the symbol All Lives Matter or Blue Lives Matter don't bother you when the simple difference in all three of these symbols is the word black. That should be a kind of a wake-up call to those who minimize and diminish the Black Lives Matter movement. We have another caller, Emma from McKinleyville. Emma?
Yeah. Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment that actually I grew up in the 50s and 60s on the East Coast, white middle class, and always believed that I come from a very liberal upbringing. And as I'm in my 60s now, honestly, I can say that, I see absolute, you know, arrogance in myself, in my thoughts at times. And I'm just going to be really upfront about it. I mean, it's like weeding a garden. I really spot it. And to tell you, I really am quite ashamed of it. And also, you know, when you see a bumper sticker or something, Black Lives Matter, to me, the whole reason, you know, that ever had to come into being, the saying Black Lives Matter, that it, I mean, I get it. And to have to counter that, you know, with, well, all lives matter, you know, actually that's insulting, you know. I think there's a place, Black Lives Matter, I get it. And really, that's about all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment,
Emma.
Thank you,
Emma.
You know, there's also, if you're tuning in and you'd like to join in the conversation, the numbers are 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. Recently, I saw another meme. I am heavily into social media, where there's always an argument. Well, if you are out demonstrating and saying Black Lives Matter, why aren't you doing that in Chicago, where there's a high black-on-black crime rate, or in Baltimore, where there's a high black-on-black crime rate? And a response that I read was, that would be equivalent saying that a person who is supporting Black Lives Matter, but not supporting all lives, is like saying, well, if ISIS came here, and because Americans aren't protecting each other, ISIS deserves to do this. I'm saying it loosely, but it's saying, you know, ISIS can come here and attack, but because we're not protecting ourselves, it's kind of, we deserve it. That it's not fair. It's not equal. I do want to say that before we go into the next hour, that we are extending the hour of Thursday Night Talk for this town hall discussion. No Room for Squares will begin at 9 p.m. tonight. We are taking an hour of his show. So thank you, Harlan Rain, for giving us that extra hour. This is Diverse Public Radio from Humboldt State University, KHSU and KHSU HD 90.5 Arcata, KHSR 91.9 Crescent City, and KHSG 89.9 Garberville. You're tuned in to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. I'm your host, Lorna Bryant. Next to me is Tay Triggs. She's the Associate Dean of Student Engagement and Leadership here at Humboldt State University. Also joining me is Paula Nettelkoff. She is a marriage and family therapist here in the community. Mikey Matthews, he is an HSU graduate and an African-American citizen of Arcata. Jeff Blank, I don't know why I'm looking at my notes. I know you all. Jeff Blank, he is a member of the Eureka branch of the NAACP, and Don Peterson, the HSU chief of police. Looks like we have another call, Christy from Arcata. Christy, go ahead.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you all doing? I know a lot of people on the show there, and I just wanted to call in and say I appreciate this opportunity for people in the community to broach this topic. I know it's been a difficult one to avoid, but also a difficult one to discuss with people because I find myself African-American female. I've been in this community since 1999. I was a student here. I have a BA. I got my master's. I work in government here, the local government, and serving the clients that I serve, it's been a challenge. I've had to request not to be placed in service areas like McKinleyville, Fortuna, nowhere in Southern Humboldt, just because of what could happen. I don't expect anything to happen, but I'm also not going to put myself in danger to deliver services to clients. And that's unfortunate because for me, I was always taught, I grew up and I was always taught that it doesn't matter, you know, what you look like. But I also grew up in South Central Los Angeles where most of the children and the people and the neighbors and the neighborhood girls and everything, everyone looked like me. And they talked like me and they raised me. And my first taste of diversity really was when I went to elementary school in the San Fernando. And then from then on through the rest of school. So, my world opened up a little bit more. And so, the first thing that a kid said to me when I got off the bus, when we came out for recess was, you can't play with us. You probably play handball differently than we do. So you have to sit right there and watch us play. And so, that was really kind of eye opening to me that like, oh, this world is different and oh, I don't belong in this part of the world. I mean, I've since grown my own sense of self and, living here, I had to, and you know, I've had my experiences on campus. Not with professors, with staff, working at the stores and stuff on campus where people refuse to come into my line. It's something that you don't try to pay attention to because some people think you're just looking for something to like catch a hold to. But when you're the only person and there's one cashier and there's like a, 10 person line and that person still gets in that line every single day, you tend to notice those things. Absolutely. And so, I do want to make it clear that I love this community, but it's been difficult to try to have discussions with people. And people have been telling me, I love you, Christy. I love you, Christy. I love you, Christy. And I understand where their heart is coming from, but in all reality, they're only telling me that because of what's going on in current news and because I'm Black, right? And mm-hmm. So it's been this really strange outpouring of love that I didn't doubt for my friend. And now I'm just kind of like, whoa, what's all this? It's really disconcerting, to be honest. But I appreciate it at the same time. And so I have this, like, ambivalence to friends reaching out, like, oh, let's talk, or I'll hold space for you. And, you know, I totally get that, and I will hold space for other people too. But, like, stuff like this feels personal to me, like, that I want to, like, process it on my own and with people that are like me and have had experiences. And again, the things that are happening, yes, are not strictly happening to only Black people, but it's disproportionately happening to people of color, not just Black people, but people of color in this country. So that's all I wanted to say. I'm just trying to come to grips with the ambivalence that I have. With people trying to reach out and it's not really feeling like they're helping me.
Yes, thank you so much for your comment, Christy. I think Tay wants to respond to your comment.
Well, I had a response period, but I see we have another caller, so I'll make it quick. In reference to this whole Black Lives Matter, what people are calling a movement, I appreciate it because, for one, I see a lot of young people who would not otherwise be activated now care about something. And I think for the last 10 years, that's all I've heard is complaints that this young generation don't care about anything but themselves. And, you know, so it makes me feel good to see the next generation kind of moving forward and stepping out there. But along with what this caller just said, I think one of the things that I really been thinking seriously about is that I don't think that people misunderstand Black Lives Matter. I think they fully understand what it's about. But to accept it and to admit it is almost like a self-indictment for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Because it forces you to reflect on the ways that you have oppressed, whether you have actively done those things or you've had those thoughts. And once you say, okay, you know, they're right. Like, this is an issue. Then it forces you to sit down and think about how you've played into this problem. And people don't want to do that.
Absolutely.
They are more comfortable living in ignorance, mm-hmm. and pretending as if this country is really built upon people pulling themselves up by their bootstraps and everyone being equal and given the same opportunity, mm-hmm. when we know that's not true. And so I'm not as nice. I don't think there's a misunderstanding of what it's about. I think people do understand what it's about. But to fight against it means you don't have to accept that you have played a part in it.
Absolutely.
Well said. Yeah. I think then when I think it was Emma, I'm trying to remember, used the word shame. I think that we want to use that feeling as, again, a way to check ourselves and to pay attention that we're aware of, as the dominant culture, we have played into it, whether we were consciously aware of it or not. Every day I have the responsibility to check myself. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is incredibly uncomfortable. I'm glad I'm okay with discomfort.
But all people are.
But I think that that is so difficult for people. But I embraced that checking and what the privilege that I have had, and that I welcome that discomfort, I guess is.
Now, we are, thank you for that comment, Paula. We are going to move into the next segment, but before we do, let's hear a clip from someone, a comment about the whole division of Black Lives, Blue Lives, All Lives Matter, those movements. This was at Janae Monday afternoon at the courthouse for a vigil. Let's hear.
My heart is just broken. The police officers, at the end of the day, if they decide that they are in too dangerous of a job and they don't want to do that anymore, they take that hat off and they could be teachers, they could be lawyers, they could do anything. That's the thing about blue lives, though. Black lives, they don't get to do that. They don't have that luxury where at the end of the day, they decide, you know what, it's too dangerous to be a black man in America. I'm just going to stop, you know?
That says it all, definitely. Now we're going to move into possibly a difficult conversation about police brutality against people of color. Now, the focus in this conversation has been about African American community. We make up just a small population of this community, but as an earlier caller said, you know, I'm passionate about it because I am an African American woman. I know there is constant bashing, especially in social media and comments in the likes of the Lost Coast Outpost about Native American people in this community, about Hispanic people in this community. And the belief seems to be that all of the violence and all of the crime is coming from outside. If that were the case, it wouldn't occur when the summer months are here and all of the outsiders go back home to Southern California and the Bay Area and South Central. So I am going to leave that point as we move into the next section. Again, the telephone numbers, if you want to join in the conversation, 707-826-4805 or 800-640-5911. We have a caller, Jenny from Arcata. Jenny?
Hey, I've been listening and there's so many aspects of your program that I'm appreciative of. I've been missing this kind of a forum for so long, and we really need it. I am a therapist. I work with policemen as well as civilians, and I work with all colors. So it's very sensitive to me that, and important that people recognize that if we hire policemen from our area, which everybody is advocating, policemen from our area are not used to people of color. And I think some extra training and intense training in sociology and psychology would really benefit the police here. The academy does not do a thorough job. And I also think that it would very much help the police here if they were required to have a four-year education, not just a credential in the police academy, which I don't believe is anything more than 3 or 4 months. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for the forum.
Thank you for your comment, Jenny. Let's go to Chris from Arcata.
Yeah, is that me?
Yes, Chris.
Okay. So basically, I was just going to call and give, you know, the Caucasian middle class kind of experience. Basically, I was going to say, you know, I'm come from European descent, and my parents and aunts and uncles were all very racist, and also from being around people who grew up here. And our, you know, older generation. I hate to make stereotypes, but basically, I just think racism or, a fear of people that are different from you comes from not being exposed, not knowing those people. And so it seems like the older generation tends to be more racist. That's just generalizing. And it seems like as people integrate more, you definitely lose a lot of that. And like somebody mentioned, you got old racists teaching, you know, young kids how to be racist. But in general, I think you see this in reformed KKK people. You know, I've seen on documentaries, basically once they get to know, some black people and realize, like, you know, they're good people just like anybody else, they lose a lot of that hate. So I think basically the point I'm making is that it's just a fear of the unknown. And as people learn to live together, you know, you're still going to have that racism, but it should be less, you know, as people integrate more. That was just my point.
Absolutely. Thank you for your comment.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Before I'm going to start the discussion with you, Don, but before we do, I'd like to go to a clip from Chief Andy Mills of the Eureka Police Department. He has a comment about implicit bias, and let's listen to that.
We always have to guard against unconscious bias. And I think that's where one of the things that there's been a lot of research done the last couple of years by the Police Executive Research Forum and others to really discuss that and to try to bring the subconscious things to the forefront. Little things like when you're walking down the street and a black man follows you, do you feel a little bit more nervous than if it's a elderly white woman? So we have to, each of us, figure out how to get past our own personal prejudices, and that including police officers. And I think the difference is when you bring a lot of authority with you and you have the ability to detain and take away people's liberties, you have to be especially conscious of those things.
Don, what do you like to add to that?
Well said, Chief Mills. I think this is an important part of the show, talking about this, and it's a difficult thing to talk about, but it's something we need to talk about. And I think staying specifically on police brutality, there's a lot of good police work that's being done in America. There's a lot of dedicated cops, and I want to, before I say anything else, speak to each of the folks, the men and women, that young woman that we heard earlier in the program, and that passion. She took that oath, just like I did, and I proudly stand with her. And I feel that passion every day that I put on my uniform. And I think that one of the things that we need to do as a community, there are some things that are going on right now. And we see a bombing or some sort of a terrorist act. And so many times we want to hear some people, maybe somebody from a particular group express angst and sorrow and I'm sorry this happened. And I think as a profession, we've maybe not done enough of that. And I think we need to be vulnerable. And I think we need to, when these things do happen, be able to have dialogue. And one of the things that I think the listening audience needs to understand too is that we're trained and empowered to be documenters of fact, to be enforcers mm-hmm. of law, but not to be juries and not to be in that part of it. And I think sometimes when it comes to that, when it comes to judging, a lot of times, you know, I might have an opinion about the coach, the call the coach made on a football game, but I'm not going to give an opinion about something that one of my counterparts did. And some of the things that happen around this country need to be talked about, and police need to be talking about them. And if we disengage from the conversation and we let other people talk about those things, we're not doing justice.
Absolutely. Anyone that I'd like to add to that?
First of all, I want to thank you. And I feel like I expect to hold someone in uniform to a higher standard. You have life and death right in your hand. And it's there's a whole power and control issue that I see when people have the power. But I want police protection. I want peacekeepers, and I hold to a very high standard. And I think that's where my just disillusionment has been, that who are these people and how did they get to this position of power? And then, quite frankly, go home and be protected by a union and get a paycheck, which I realize is bigger, and I don't want to belabor that, but I want to thank you for your time, for your service, and I count on my law enforcement people locally and nationally, and I hold a high standard.
There was a case, forgive me, there have been many, many instances, and you know, rather than picking out one, there was a case where I watched a police officer shoot a man as he fled in the back and then go over and drop a taser on his dead body. And while the police officer in me doesn't want to judge, I'm in solidarity with that young woman and what mm-hmm. she said. I screamed out, that's murder. Mm-hmm. That's murder. And if a police officer is afraid of a black man reaching into his back pocket to get his wallet and that causes him to discharge his weapon, I don't know how else to say it. He should not be a police officer.
Thank you.
There's no other nice way to say that. And there are probably officers out there who might have a different opinion. I can't but respect that. But if I watch somebody reach into their back pocket and that scares me, I should be cautious. Police officers are killed on traffic mm-hmm. stops. But when I ask you for your license and your identification and you say, I'm going to reach in my pocket, and you do exactly what you say you're going to do, and I'm so scared that I have to shoot you and kill you, maybe it's not the profession mm-hmm. that you should be in.
Right. Jeff?
Yeah, and I think what goes along with it is my wife tells me this. She goes, what's happening now is, I think with social media and technology, we're seeing it. It's been going on for decades.
Absolutely.
And hundreds of years. And Tim Wise wrote a book, Dear White America, and you know, the history that we're dealing with is that this nation was simply put, conceived in a plague by formal white supremacy for over 350 years. Going back to the colonial period, it was a system of racial fascism. Now, he says, that doesn't mean I'm anti-American. It just means you got to look at the history. Mm-hmm. Where'd it come from? And if we don't want to do that, there's a problem. And so when dealing with police now, it's like, yeah, there are. We're talking about bad police officers. There's bad everything in every profession.
Right.
It's just that these guys control life and death.
Right. To add to that historical statement, I'm from Los Angeles. Los Angeles Police Department headquarters is called Parker Center. In the 30s and 40s, I believe it was, Chief Parker was the chief of police. During that time, in the 40s, during World War II, the Great Southern Migration occurred when blacks from southern states moved to California. There is a pocket of people from Louisiana here in the Eureka, Arcata area, but a large percentage, my parents included, in the 40s, moved from Mississippi, Texas, Louisiana. And Chief Parker felt it was necessary to corral the blacks, excuse me, the coloreds who were coming from the South. So what did he do? He went to those southern states and enlisted the help of former military policemen who were racist from the South to be recruited as police officers in Los Angeles. And so it begins. Mm-hmm. And so it begins. I think we have a caller, Jennifer from West Haven. Jennifer, your comment or question? Jennifer, are you there? Well, we have another Jennifer on the line from McKinleyville. Jennifer, number two, are you there?
I am here.
Well, welcome. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, hi. So I am actually a professor of sociology at Humboldt State, and also the Bias Education Initiative Coordinator at Humboldt. And one piece I hear it being talked about, and I think actually in your last comment about, you know, sort of the history of L.A. and policing there. I'm sorry, my border collie's barking in the background of a toy.
She has a comment, too.
Yeah, he does always have a comment. One of the things that I think is easy to overlook is that this is structured into the very core of our society. That this it's sometimes tempting to think about bad apples. And I've heard that a lot of conversation about that in terms of, you know, we have bad apples in different police departments, or we have bad apples, you know, who say bad things, right? We have a particular neighbor, we have a particular problem, and, you know, they're the bad apple. And what I actually think is that we need to think about the barrel.
Mm.
That it's too easy to think, once we start thinking about it being an individual issue, and a prejudice issue, and those things, we lose sight of the reality that it's built in our structure. So, you know, you have to factor in segregated housing as planned, enforced system of white domination that then is linked directly with policing historically. So that those, you know, the fact that so many white people grow up with virtually no contact with African Americans, except for what they see on television or movies, right, which again is structure, right, media, is really problematic because those images are highly flawed and limited and negative and all those things. So all of these different pieces, housing and policing and media and education, right? If you know, look at the statistics on education and where and how people are educated and the disparate funding for schools for black and brown kids. All of those things feed together to create this moment. And I always think it's really important to remind myself of that and other people of that because it's easy to end up going, we just need to educate people.
Absolutely.
And somehow if we just educate people, this magically disappears. Well, the reality is we have the most educated population we've ever had, right? And we have a continuation of systematic, brutal racism So those two things are side by side, right? It's not a matter. What's gone away is, in general, is this degree of white folks who will explicitly say they favor one, their own race over the other. But, you know, highly educated whites tend to live in neighborhoods with other highly educated whites.
Right.
Even though if you ask people that same group what they're, you know, about issues relating to race, they would sound very colorblind, then they would often frame themselves that way and all those things, right? And it's, in fact, the colorblind people who are often saying all lives matter. So I don't mean to go on too long, and I'll end now. I guess I just want to say it's important to me to always remember how these structural pieces all fit together. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, some bad individuals. We really need to think about the barrels.
Absolutely. Well said. Thank you very much, Jennifer, for your comment.
Yes, no problem.
Thank you. Jeff, would you like to add to that?
The term that the NAACP keeps using is institutional racism. In other words, you have this long history of racism in our country that has evolved to where there are white privileges. Mm-hmm. And if you're white, you know, I'm white, it's like you get the benefit of that privilege without doing anything. So I'm not guilty for what happened in the past, but I do bear a responsibility of what I want to do in the present.
Absolutely.
To correct mm-hmm. the inequities that exist based on that system.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I was concerned about being able to fill 2 hours with this discussion, and time is winding down, and there's so much more to talk about. So maybe this warrants another conversation and another discussion. Let's go to a caller, Tina from Manila. Tina, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for your call, Tina.
Thank you for the segment. It's very much appreciated. The comments that I have, they definitely coincide with the previous caller. I feel that she definitely gave a very in-depth view that's not really talked about as far as, like, how this racism is structured within society. And I noticed that someone else brought up Tim Wise.
Yes.
Who also talks a lot about this white supremacy and this institutional racism, but from a white perspective. And I myself, I'm going to be in my last semester at HSU, and I am a critical race and gender sexuality studies major. And just during the course of my time at HSU and learning about these things, I've just been mind blown just about how embedded these things are into our society because of those who are in power. And when I was maybe a freshman or a sophomore learning this stuff, I'll never forget my teacher had brought up Bacon's Rebellion one day about how back in the day, I want to say it was around the 1600s. I might not be too sure about that, but everyone has mostly have heard of Bacon's Rebellion. But pretty much, like, this is where poor whites and I think, like, poor blacks or, like, slaves, they banded together to rebel against the wealthy, those that were in power in the day back then. And when those who were in power saw that these people were banding together against them, because it was really more of, like, a class issue in a sense, as well as the racism being beginning to be an issue as well. So they wanted to make sure that these poor whites and these blacks didn't brand together. So what they did was they created the idea of telling, like, white people that, which was also mentioned, that basically being white in itself was a privilege, even if it didn't come with any material possessions, in a way to kind of, you know, trick the poor whites in believing that they didn't have anything in common with the black slaves. And I just think that that's, like, a really powerful, like, mechanism that they have, you know, that has been executed to divide us, you know, kind of like at the ground level. You know, we're fighting amongst each other when those in power, you know, they have the real, true power to change things. As the caller before mentioned about, you know, like, all of the ways that blacks have been disadvantaged through, you know, laws and things like that. And so I just wanted to, you know, just Like, I really appreciate, you know, the sociology professor to mention those things. And because I feel like that's something that's not really talked about, is really just people's prejudice. And there's also a difference between racism and prejudice, you know. From what I've understand as a student of this, is that racism is really embedded in power. And that's how you hear institutionalized racism come up a lot. And everyday people, you know, like how the woman said that, you know, the guy came to her and said he doesn't want any N-words on the block. That's his own really prejudice, you know. And I just think that, you know, a lot of time we get caught up and confused about racism and prejudice. But I did have a question for Mr. Peterson. Thank you for being on the segment. I just have a question about, can you give us some insight into the training process of police officers? Basically, like, what are the guidelines given to police officers when they are trying to disarm a suspect or, like, take them into custody? Not even disarm, because most of the time these people aren't armed. Like, are there no, like, shoot to wound things, or is it, you know, do they, like, tell you to just take the person out, kill them? Like, can you just give us some insight into, like, what is the, you know, guidelines that you guys are given as far as being able to shoot people? If that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
So, thank you for you know, the segment, and I will be with great insight. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Tina. Don?
Yeah. I appreciate Tina's question and her insights, and I believe it's the same Tina has come up to me on campus, and we've had some interesting conversations, and she's asked me some tough questions, and questions that really made me stop and pause and think and really evaluate my conventions. And so I do appreciate that, and I think that dialogue is really important. To answer her question, a lot of training, and I think we have, in respect of time, not enough to deal with that issue. It's a complex issue. There's a use of force escalation that police officers are trained on. It starts at presence, and it goes all the way through deadly force. She asked, do you train people to shoot to wound? No, we don't. That's not something that's part of training. Shooting is not, I cringe when I hear people say shoot to kill, because that's not trained either. Police officers, when they use deadly force, are attempting to stop a threat. That's what the use of that particular force level is all about. And in Tina, I would love to have this conversation with you. I'll buy the coffee, and I will give you a lot more insight than that. I just don't know that this is really the format, and if we have enough time to really do it justice. But there is a lot of training that goes into that, and it's carried out over the course of the career. It's also recurring and perishable skills training that takes place not just at the beginning, but throughout, to include myself at 30 years, I go through it.
Well, like I said earlier, this conversation definitely warrants more time, and I'd like to invite you all to have another conversation, especially you, Tay, as the new semester begins, in light of what's gone on in this nation. We'll have new bright-eyed, bushy-tail, eager students coming from other areas coming into this community, and some may have fears of police because of their interaction with police in their communities. We may have some who come as student activists donning their Black Lives Matter t-shirts.
Definitely.
Our professors and administrators and staff members here at the university and community at large, are they prepared for that?
Well, you know, I honestly think that we're moving in the right direction, and that we had a campus-wide meeting, and it's hard because it's summer. Most of our staff are away for the summer, and but we did have a meeting and kind of had a discussion about everything that's going on. One, to just talk about our students as well as our own self-care, right? We're educators, but you know, we're humans moving through this world as well, and we have our own emotions and feelings about the things that have happened, and that dialogue is going to continue. We're actually hosting a discussion tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the library fishbowl at the university, and we're going to be speaking with having a webinar and having a discussion about where do we go from here. And our hope is that we will be proactive in terms of preparing for the students to come back and having dialogue. I think we would be remiss to not have anything planned or to act as if the world has not impacted our students, and because it has.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what we want as Humboldt State University. We want students who are civically engaged and who are, you know, moving toward understanding the world and their world in it, their role in it. And so I do anticipate that we'll have quite a few opportunities for dialogue with the students in the fall.
Right. I have heard the phrase self-care. A lot of African Americans are truly feeling trauma,
yes,
witnessing, because of social media, executions in real time. And there's time to turn off. That was the reason why I invited Paula here as a therapist to talk about self-care. And we're going to talk about that in the final segment. Where do we go from here? But, you know, I am sure I can speak for you, Mikey, and you, Tay, and for myself. People have come up to me as if I was the black spokesperson in the community, saying, what can I do? And, you know, that's a heavy, heavy, heavy burden to bear, especially when you are in the midst of trauma and trying to process what's going on. And the only thing I can offer is, don't close a blind eye. When you see irresponsible behavior, action, speech, conversation, say something. Call people out on their nonsense, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. That is a starting point. Mm-hmm. We have a caller from Eureka, Eli. Eli, are you there?
I wanted to circle back to the concept of implicit bias and talk about a tool for diagnosing that. There's an online test. It's called the Implicit Association Test for Race, and mm-hmm. it's developed by Harvard University, and it's available on their website. And anyone can go and take it. It just takes, you know, maybe five or 10 minutes, and it's pretty interesting. What it does is it flashes words and faces on the screen, and it tests the speed at which you can link together different combinations of basically words with good and bad connotations, and black and white, different black and white faces, people's faces.
Yes.
And I took the test, and it was really pretty, it was eye-opening, but it was also kind of shocking and sad. And basically what happened is that in my brain, the concepts of you know, white faces and good, that's an automatic link to me. That link is there. And then when they would show the black faces and I would have to push, you know, the button for good, it was like my brain had to do a conscious override. And it took me an extra, you know, not very long, but like a half second. It was like I had to do this manual override to overcome that.
Yes.
And so this test is able to basically, you know, diagnose how much unconscious bias do you have. And I really encourage everyone to take it. And it's, you know, it's uncomfortable. I don't think of myself as being a prejudiced person. And I pride myself on, you know, equality being one of my core values, and so it was pretty upsetting. And I mean, I think it's basically just this country is, you know, steeped in a toxic legacy of racism and discrimination. And I think, you know, being a white person living most of my life in the North Coast, I just haven't had enough, you know, close personal relationships with people of color to overcome kind of this the baseline, you know, racist toxicity of America.
Hey, Eli.
So, yeah?
I'll be your friend.
All right.
Thank you for that comment. I have taken that test myself, and it is shocking. I will make sure we will have a link to that Harvard test, the Harvard University Implicit Bias Test, on our website at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. Again, our numbers, if you want to add to the discussion, 826-4805 or 800-640-5911. There is a comment from Twitter, And it's directed to the University Police Department. Actually, a couple of comments about Officer Tompkins and his continued employment with HSU Police Department. They want to talk about his racial profiling of students of color on the HSU campus. Now, I don't know how much, Don, you are able to discuss this matter, but that is a question that was brought from Twitter about Officer Tompkins and his still being employed by the university on the police department.
Haven't had any conversation with anybody about that. That's never been brought to my attention. There has been some conversation about an incident that Officer Tompkins was involved in the past, and I've watched Officer Tompkins at work and find him to be an outstanding officer, and he's one of the guys that gets it. And I think he's got a lot of passion. He wears it on his sleeve. I think his heart breaks just like mine with some of the incidents that occur on campus. And some of the things that he gets as a result of the incident he was involved in, I would just say that now that that case has been litigated, he was actually sticking up for a disabled female student on campus who was being stalked. And I'm happy to work with him, and I don't have any issue with Officer Tompkins at all. He's not somebody that I have had any conversation with. So the comments you just shared with me are brand new, been here a year and a half, and I've never heard those things before.
Okay, thank you for that. I've just got note that the implicit bias link is now posted to KHSU. We have another caller, B from Trinidad. B, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for this forum this evening and your guests and their very heartfelt stories. You mentioned, Lorna, a few minutes ago about the shock of all of this. And we put shock away in places that they come up in times like this, particularly for me. My story is I was born in Newark, New Jersey. I went to school there. And until I was in eighth grade, and then moved to the sticks, as my mother would say, about 30 miles south and in a more of a rural area. Now, when I was young, I paid attention to everything, whether it be music or arts or sports or whatever it was. And I paid very close attention to my dad and his brothers and when all the men would be getting together. Because one of his brothers was a police officer in Newark, New Jersey. Now, what scared me when I was probably not even 5 years old was to hear him tell his tales about, they only had nightsticks at the time. It wasn't this up-to-date weapons of war that our police now carry in the streets. It was just a nightstick, but those nightsticks created a lot of damage. And the language that I would hear him speak of, about how he would break these boys' backs, how he and his fellow officers would bloody them, how they might even throw them in Weak Wake Park because they killed them. Mm-hmm. This was very upsetting to a young child. So when we moved to the sticks shortly after that, I was in high school, and it was the riots of Newark in 1967. We talked about having this go on for decades. We've been seeing this for decades. This is almost 50 years now. Next year it will be 50 years. What are the similarities? The similarities are, I think it was a taxi cab driver who had gotten pulled in and probably beat up a little bit and then released, but he died afterwards. Mm. One thing led to another. There's a similarity today, even though it was just nightsticks. But for me, what this does, especially the past 2 weeks, is it's pushed in me this feeling of when I was 5 years old again, listening to that man that I became scared of. It is in our families, and we need to talk about that, too. Now, I moved 3,000 miles in either direction to get away from that, and I see the difference between some hardcore and some lightcore and some softcore racism that's in my family. But what do we do with that? Well, for me, I think that might have instigated in me a sense of becoming a social worker, becoming when I did graduate from high school, going back and being with my friends in Newark and helping to elect the first black mayor of Newark. It's
being involved in something that makes you feel somewhat empowered, and that does go to the healing that we need. Now, what I probably didn't need to do was knowing that this program was going to be on, and I probably would call because I really need to talk about this, is I didn't need to go on my iPad and look up this old information and to see that picture that was in the front page of the North Star Ledger with my uncle on it, with a man who's bleeding, a black man who's bleeding from his head, from the nightstick. That was on the front page. And it was, you put that away, and it comes up. And now it's coming up, and it's coming up, and it's coming up. And I thank you very much for affording me an opportunity to tell a story and to tell a tale and to put it someplace now.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So time is winding down again. I'd like to invite each of you again to have yet another conversation. This conversation must continue. Let's do it again in August. Is that okay with you all?
Sure.
So this last half hour, which has resorted to the last 10 minutes, was about where do we go from here? And I don't know. Where do we go from here? So let's start with you, Jeff, and probably let's give it to 2 to 3 minutes for each of us to speak.
Sure, because when, you know, I got married and race became personal, you know, it was a white person, you could see all these things. I was like, what can I do? And there's stuff locally you can see and react to, but I strongly encourage people to join the NAACP. Mm-hmm. It's the oldest civil rights organization in the country. And there's a local branch and they can deal with local issues, but by joining, you're joining the national organization. So they are dealing with these issues that we're all talking about. And on the national website, there's a publication called Born Suspect. It came out in 2014 about racial profiling, and the consequences thereof. They're dealing with this. There's suggestions, and it's helped me feel it's like I'm now part of an organization that, yeah, we can do something, and there's some place to go for resources. Locally, it's the Eureka NAACP. The PO box is 1434 Eureka 95502. You can, it's $30 a year to join. It's one of the best bargains left around. They haven't raised it. It's for 30 a year and 15 a year for students. And you'll get the Crisis Magazine, which deals with a lot of things. But with forums like this and talking to people, and I think a lot of it is education and history. But that's come up a lot. It's like you have to know the past and where we're coming from, definitely so you don't do it again. Mm-hmm. But then you know what you're dealing with to level the playing field.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Full disclosure, I am a member of that branch and also the webmaster. Don Peterson is a member of that branch as well.
I am also a member who owes dues.
Again, full disclosure, me too. But I put in work because I am the webmaster. And speaking of being the webmaster, we do have a website, EurekaNAACP.org. You can get more information there. We do have a listener who would like Don to elaborate more on police bias and de-escalation training. We don't have the time for that, but Don, if I could ask you to write something so we can share with our listeners and put it on our website, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
We will get that information.
And I can touch on it a little bit when I get my 2 minutes.
Okay, let's give you 2 minutes right now.
I value the conversation. I sat in a room and listened to folks yesterday a couple of times talk. And part of what's not happening is listening. And I think people are very quick to begin to respond. And when you're thinking about your response, you're really not listening. And Tay spoke very passionately yesterday in that event, and I learned so much just by shutting my mouth. Mm. And I'd reach out to the folks who Twittered in specifically about Dell. And, you know, Dell's a human being, and Dell has got a family and roots in the community, and he's a good man. He protects our campus. He protects our students. And rather than taking shots at Dell or anybody else, Tina, or called earlier, she has come up to me little tiny Tina looked up at me and said some things to me that really rocked me back on my heels. And I so value that. And I know Del would too. And so if you're one of those folks out there on Twitter who was taking exception, I think you've been misinformed. And I think maybe if you were to see Del on campus and go up and talk to him, you might get to know the guy and you might really come away with a different opinion. And I think a lot of us really want to be able to do that. We want to be able to talk. But more important, Lorna, I think really what we want to do as our students come back to campus in the fall is we want to listen. We really want to listen to what the experiences are and embrace them as they come to HSU and help be part of a good experience where they do go away with a degree. And I guess I would just leave it at that.
Okay. Let's go to you, Paula. Let's talk about it. I know 2 minutes is diminishing the subject matter, but let's talk about self-care and wrapping up, if you can.
I think, in a nutshell, listening, that was very well said. I think we live in a world where everybody is so quick and everything is so quick. People don't take the time to listen and oftentimes hear what they think they hear versus what maybe the communicator was saying. I think I can't speak for anybody else, but I need to take good care of me. If I'm taking care of me and I'm aware of what that is, then I'm going to be stronger for my family, my community, my neighbors, and the world. So I think it's important for people to pay attention to what is it that they need to take care of themselves. For somebody that might be the ocean, for somebody that might be therapy, for somebody that might be dialogue, whatever it is, how do you keep yourself strong so you can then be there and be part of the growth and change? I think that that's huge. So I will leave it at that. Self-care is about loving yourself. If you love yourself, then that love and kindness will come out of you.
For me, it's a hug from my granddaughter. Mm-hmm. And I will challenge anyone. You can't be angry and skip at the same time.
Right on.
It is a proven scientific by Lorna, scientific fact, there's no way you can skip and be angry at the same time. So when you're angry, just skip away.
Mm-hmm. Just a visual of that is hilarious.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the truth. When you're mad, skip. To my Lou, my darling, even. Let's go to Ute, ending comments and what the students can expect, maybe, if you want to touch upon that again.
I'm not sure because when people say, where do we go from here? I'm like, you know, where are we right now? I'm not sure which direction we should go and not sure what conversations need to be had. I just know there needs to be conversation. There needs to be more dialogue and people need to be open. If you walk into a situation with your guard up and ready to defend, then you're not going to learn anything. And you're not going to see anyone else's perspective. And you're not going to appreciate the next person's experiences. Because they may not be your own, but that doesn't make them any less real. Mm-hmm. I'm around the community a lot and very rarely hear people having real dialogue. It's almost like they're purposely avoiding talking about it. And that's not going to make it go away. You know, in my mind, this is not just about police abuse of power. We know that's an issue. That's been an issue for a long time. But what the bigger issue is, I think, is just our ability to sit down and talk about this racism thing that has plagued our country for a long time, and we refuse to face it head on. And that means changing people's hearts, changing their minds, and that is difficult work. Mm-hmm. And what makes me upset is that I feel as Americans, we're lazy. We want to take the easy way out to avoid it and not have the conversation and just live in our little bubble. When did we become such a lazy country?
Hmm.
When do we, you know, want to do what's easy? We didn't get this powerful reputation that we have by doing that. It's hard work, but it's work that needs to happen. You know, unfortunately, we're going to have tons of people who aren't proud to be Americans because they don't feel like they've been fully accepted in this country in which they live and spend their time and give their energy. So we have to do better.
Absolutely.
Why can't we start at Humboldt County?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Let's not shoot to be mediocre. Let's shoot to be better.
Let's not shoot at all.
Well, yeah.
Well,
very
said,
good point.
Don.
Absolutely. There are two callers waiting, and unfortunately, we don't have the time, but I will answer your calls at the end of the show individually. I have a good friend in Texas, and every time he calls me, I don't call him by his name. I greet him with black man, black man, black man. So it's time to look to you. Black man, black man. Young black man.
Thank you, Queen.
Yeah, thank you.
And
truly, to like a minute and a half.
Yeah, I'm gonna keep it very short and sweet. I came here not prepared. Definitely wanted to listen to everybody and what they had to say about the whole topic, because it goes a lot deeper. Just like what Tina and forgot the. The sociology teachers,
Jennifer.
Right. It goes very deep. And for me to talk on it, this will be probably a week's worth of conversation. But as far as where we go from here, it's challenging structures and rethinking structures and looking at society and kind of breaking those bubbles that we are in, because everybody is so privatized in their own minds, and there's a huge epidemic of trust issues. Nobody can trust anybody anymore. And so there's this misguided energy, which also is hopelessness. So it can go any direction, and it's usually not in the best direction. And we need to definitely take it to the repressive institution and like, okay, where's accountability? You have to take accountability. You know, if we can't trust you, if, you know, you're not calling out yourselves in your own unit, like, so, you know. But, yeah, it's just taking it back to the community and having a conversation and doing more about it.
Absolutely.
Self-sufficiency.
I know we're running short on time. Mikey, I'd like you to tell me, I'm a police officer, and I think a lot of people would like to hear, talk to me. Tell me how you feel. Tell me what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right here. You know, we're out on the street, mm-hmm. and I just pulled you over in a car. Share your yeah. thoughts with me. Give me some insight.
Yeah, we need that. We need more of that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I want to reiterate that what I said in the beginning of the show, the guests that join me here, they don't have the answers. But perhaps collectively, we can help each other affect change in our own backyards. When I was a student here in during the 1987-1988 school year, I was fortunate enough to meet a woman by the name of Shirley Chisholm.
Nice.
And I was standing on the fringe watching her, and she said, come here, come talk to me. And she gave me a tongue-lashing like she was my mama. And she asked me what I wanted to do with my life. And she basically said, you know, stay in school and education is important. I want to end with a quote from her. You don't make progress by standing on the sidelines, whimpering and complaining. You make progress by implementing ideas. Don, Jeff, Mikey, Paula, and Tay, thank you. Thank you for your ideas. Also, I would like to thank you a few other thank yous for the show today. Thank you to Geraldine Goldberg, Michael Roccaforte, and Katie Whiteside, Mike Dronkers, Thursday Night Talk host Brenda Starr, Harlan Rain, and anyone else I may have forgotten, thank you. And most of all, thank you to the listener. Just a note, an archive of this program will be available on our website at khsu.org in the coming hours. This conversation definitely will continue on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
You have been listening to Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Thanks to our host, Lona Bryant, and our guests, Michael Matthews, Jeff Blank, Tay Triggs, Don Peterson, and Paula Nedelkoff. We'd love to get feedbacks on our programs. Please email thursdaynighttalk@khsu.org. Like our Facebook page, Thursday Night Talk on KHSU. Coming up next week on TNT, Who Says Sports, Race, and Politics Don't Mix Well? There is a long history of mingling social justice and society in sports, from Jesse Owens to Jackie Robinson to Jim Brown to Muhammad Ali. On the next Thursday Night Talk, Doc Stoll and Brenda Starr discuss sports as seen through the lens of race, politics, and protests throughout our history. Join the conversation with Doc and Starr, July 21st, beginning at 7. Thank you to KHSU Thursday Night Talk producer Geraldine Goldberg. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jeff Kreider. My name is Michael. I've been your studio engineer tonight. Stay tuned to KHSU. No Room for Squares is coming up next.